Michael, I think you probably had turned away from the phone for 2 seconds and I started to play my record, so we lost you there for a moment, but welcome to The Blurb.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm sorry I'm late.
No, that's fine. We're very laid back. We don't get too excited about most things here at The Blurb down here in Geelong. It used to be called Sleepy Hollow, Michael. We still tend to wear that crown rather proudly. I'll pass you on to my colleague, John Bartlett, who's going to have a chat to you with you about your latest book.
All right, thank you.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Hello, John. How are you?
I think this is probably your second time on The Blurb. I think Bert had talked to you last year about your first crime novel, The Tower.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
The Tower. You're becoming a popular person on the Blurb.
All right, okay.
Now, I'd like to talk to you today mostly about your most recent book, Call Me Cruel, which is a true crime novel. So a little bit of a change of direction from your other crime novels, perhaps. But perhaps for the listeners, I'll just say a little bit about your own background. You write regularly for the Sydney Morning Herald. I noticed yesterday you wrote a very interesting opinion piece in The Age, which we might get a chance to say something about. And you're also a co-presenter on Counterpoint on ABC's Radio National. And you've published, as I say, two crime novels, The Tower and The Simple Death. But you've also written a biography of John MacArthur and also a book on Latham and Abbott, which traced the lives of the rivalry of politicians, which I guess is a very strong theme at the moment in politics.
Yes, I wrote those two books some time ago, but I suppose they suggested an interest in extreme behaviour, which I've now followed to its logical conclusion in the criminal milieu.
Yes, well, I wanted to ask you, what led to this life of crime?
Partly I used to be a political commentator for about 10 years, and I got a bit bored with it because the same stories started to come around. Once you've covered one or two leadership challenges, they tend to follow a pattern, and I was just interested in finding a subject matter that had a greater diversity of behaviour. That was also somewhat dramatic, and I ended up in crime.
So a bit of a sidetrack, but are you likely to write a Rudd Gillard book on...
No, I've left politics right behind me now. I think with crime I've found my true calling. It's infinitely fascinating. Of course, it's not all of life, but trials and criminal cases and investigations certainly involve a far greater range of human experience, for both better and worse than the relatively narrow world of politics.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the human experience, you know, in a little while, because I think that's one of the features certainly of both your fiction, crime fiction, and also your true crime. But just a little bit of background perhaps on your latest book, Call Me Cruel, which is published by Allen and Unwin. This is a case of Paul Wilkinson in Sydney, who was convicted for the murder of Kylie Labuchardière.
Yeah.
And he was a pretty unusual man, very much into deceit. He knew a lot about police procedure. And as a result, he sort of strung her family along during the investigation, you know, which is a real torture for them, and right through the judicial proceedings. And I think along the way, he set fire to his house. He fabricated evidence that Kylie was still alive and managed to accuse a police sergeant of her murder, and also sent police to 5 alleged grave sites, but her body has never been found. So why this story as opposed to other crime stories? Because there's been a few Sydney crime stories in the news recently, mostly people being let off crimes. What was it about this story that captured your imagination?
Well, when I started covering trials about 4 or 5 years ago as a journalist, I was curious to see how they might differ, how real crime might differ from fictional crime, because I was fortunate, I guess like most people, that my own experience of murder had only been, you know, in reading crime novels or in TV drama series, and it struck me fairly quickly that the people who commit murders are usually often pretty ordinary people. Often they don't have any criminal background at all, and they end up committing a murder because of some unfortunate circumstances. Mm. I'm not saying we could all do it, but I think often they are reasonably ordinary people. And I was just struck by this fellow, Paul Wilkinson, in this particular case, because he wasn't like that at all. He was a very unusual person, in some ways more like the sort of person you might read about in a novel, because of the level of deceit he used in his whole life, the fantasies that he wove and the way he managed to entrap people, and also by his knowledge of police procedure and how once he'd committed this horrible murder, he sort of proceeded to taunt the police to try and frame someone else. I guess, you know, when you're creating a fictional villain, often you have to make the character more elaborate than in reality to keep the book going for a couple of hundred pages. But
yes.
In reality, it's actually quite rare to find someone like Paul Wilkinson. And I was just so struck by him, and also by the grief that he put Kylie's family through, that I just felt I could write a book about it.
So is it true to say that it was as much a psychological exploration as a sort of a whodunit story for you?
Oh, absolutely. The police actually... pretty sure it was him right from the beginning, but it was a circumstantial case without any forensic evidence whatsoever. They had no crime scene, there was certainly no body. And it was really, it was just like a sort of a psychological battle for about 7 years before they finally got him. And as I say in the book, the only reason they actually did get him was because he sort of cracked in the sense that he started to believe his own lies and fantasies and ended up committing an action trying to frame this other policeman that was just so outrageous that it actually forced the police to reopen the investigation that really had shut down effectively years earlier.
And you do sort of a psychological exploration of some of the other characters too? That seems to be sort of...
Well, I'm very interested in, and this obviously goes beyond this particular crime book, I'm very interested in the whole area of truth and the extent I think people tell lies or engage in fantasies and deception and self-deception far more than many of us might like to realise. And I just thought this was an extreme case of that, where I could explore that part of human experience that I think we all have some of it in us. But he took it further, and I was particularly interested in the way he seemed to be able to target or select people who would believe his lies, probably through a process of elimination. He came to surround himself by people who were, I guess, a bit gullible, unfortunately. Not that it excuses what he did for a moment, but I was interested in that relationship between a liar and a liar's, if you like, audience.
Yes. So you wrote the two crime novels that I mentioned before. The hero of these is Nicholas Troy, before you turn to this true crime story. I'm interested in the writing, how the writing process differed for both of these. I mean, I think you touched on it a little bit earlier. Is it true to say that with this true crime, it's probably a little bit easier in that you know the facts and you have to stick to the facts, whereas with a fictional story, you can make up some of the details, I guess, can't you, to get you out of a tight corner? So how does the process differ for these two different types of writing?
The most important general thing, I think, in both forms of writing is point of view, because a writer really has to go through some version of the emotional experience of the people in a book, I think, whether that be fiction or non-fiction. You have to, if it's non-fiction, you have to try and put yourself in people's shoes. So you look at a big story like this, it's, I mean, whose shoes do you want to really be in? And I decided in this case it was the family that I really felt for. It was this grief, which as a journalist covering crime very rarely talk about the victims or the grief, but sitting through the trial and the court appearances, I was really struck by this, and I got to know the family who were quite good in telling me a lot of what was going on in their lives.
Yes.
But I would say the enormous difference between the two types of writing is just the grief and horror of non-fiction. You know, fictional crime, I think, whether we're writers or readers, we do it for a lot of reasons, which we might go into later, but we do it for a lot of reasons that don't really have a lot to do with real crime. And I think once you start to consider crime in real life, it's a totally different sort of experience and book. And I found it, while technically maybe a bit easier for the reason you suggested, that the facts are already there for you once you uncover them, I found emotionally it was a very rough experience. Obviously, you know, a million times rougher for the family involved, but to encounter that level of sadness and grief was very moving.
Well, I was just thinking as you were talking, I suppose a fictional crime story is a bit of an escapist thing for many of us, whereas there certainly isn't much escapism in this true crime story. It's emotionally very involving and you know, quite exhausting.
Well, no, totally. If you think about any, or most, not every, but many, perhaps most crime novels and certainly crime TV shows, basically the grief of the victims is sort of washed out of it. You know, it's almost not there. It might be there for a few seconds, but that's all. As you say, it is in a strange sort of way. I don't know if it's exactly escapism, but we're drawn to that fictional crime for other reasons. It's to do with, you know, the search, the puzzle, purging certain certain ideas about death, I suppose, and that sort of thing.
Now, the other thing about Call Me Cruel is, to me, was the complexity of the story. Now, the details, you know, are incredible. The details of transcripts, interviews with various people that you must have had to go through. And I understand that there were actually 23,000 text messages between Paul Wilkinson and Kylie. How did you keep control of all this information and decide on a structure?
Yeah, now that's a very good point, because non-fiction writers are really, you know, you're in the control of the facts that are available to you, and you never know everything. I was fortunate in this case to have the police force, the New South Wales Police Force, gave me access to the detective in charge, which is actually not that easy to get, and then I was able to get the brief of evidence from the court, which had an enormous amount of detail in it about psychological reports, yeah, and phone taps and that sort of thing. So I was fortunate to have all that, definitely. And then I was able to talk to members of the family and to Paul Wilkinson's ex-wife and different people. But, I mean, there's a lot of work involved, there's no doubt about it. Again, very different to writing fiction, where you just sort of, you know, sit in a room, basically.
Yes.
Try and keep yourself from getting up and making a cup of tea. And, you know, you keep writing, whereby in non-fiction, at least in the early stages, you've really got to get out there and dig.
Now, I also, after reading Call Me Cruel, I went and read your second Nicholas Troy novel, The Simple Death, which I think was published last year. And it struck me too that it's quite complex too, and it's an exploration of lots of issues in that particular book. You explore the whole idea of euthanasia, and not from a judgmental point of view at all. There's a lot of sympathy for the people who find themselves involved in, you know, perpetrating the euthanasia. Lots of complex things happening there too.
I think the crime novel, I mean, well, it has been used by other writers, and I'm inspired by them. That, you know, you can write about things that are going on, and I'm very interested in that whole issue of voluntary euthanasia, or people who assist other people to commit suicide. Mm. It's one of those sort of hot issues in our culture, I suppose, now, where we have over 80% of the population agree with it, and yet the politicians won't pass the laws allowing it to happen, so people then are breaking the law. And, you know, it raises that question of is the law actually a moral law or not? And as you suggested, I didn't actually want to come down. I didn't want the book to be a polemic, but I did want to write about people who are trapped in that situation. And unlike most of us, maybe they can't just put down the newspaper or walk away from it. If you're confronted with someone you love who's actually dying in a lot of pain, and that does happen, you've got to make a decision now. Mm. And I just thought that was an important issue, and also a very dramatic one.
Well, it's almost as much about an exploration of some of those issues as it is about, you know, a whodunit story.
Yeah, no,
which adds another whole depth to it.
It's a different sort of crime novel, I suppose. But it's one I enjoy doing. The first one was The Tower, was all about the issue of immigration. I'm very interested in globalisation, increasing the flow of people around the world at every level, from refugees and illegal workers right up to sort of professional expats and the sorts of criminal opportunities and human misery and so on that can create too. So, I mean, I am looking forward to continuing to write about those sorts of reflections on the society we live in using the crime novel.
So do you think you'll pursue them through the crime fiction rather than true crime?
Oh, I hope so, because you can really do what you want in fiction as long as the readers
That's
come
right.
along with you. The next one is about drive-by shootings and about Lebanese crime gangs in Sydney, which is another issue that I keep coming across in my daily coverage of, you know, trials in Sydney. It's a real thing here.
You mentioned crime writers. I'm just wondering who are the crime writers that affect you, that you read?
Yeah, I guess, as you'd imagine, I like the ones who are trying to say something about their societies. So I like mainly American ones, and some that spring to mind would be Richard Price, who's a little-known American writer who did a book called Lush Life 2 years ago. And I like George Pelicanos, who's better known, he's written about 20 crime books set in Washington, and I don't think he's ever written about a politician or noted the fact that it's the capital. He just writes about the sort of the ordinary people of Washington. I like that very much.
Yes.
There are lots of other crime novels I write You know, I like some of the Swedish ones. I like Ian Rebus. I like Michael Connolly. I mean, I've got fairly Catholic taste.
Yes.
I am drawn to those ones that are trying to do just a little bit more.
A bit more, yes. Now, your crime novels are set in Sydney. I'm just wondering, do you think that crime has particular characteristics according to particular Sydneys? I know I'm just about to head off to Adelaide for the Writers' Week, and of course Adelaide has got a reputation as being a cruel city, I think, according to Stephen Orr, who's just written a book about it, called it the murder capital of Australia. Do you think there are particular crimes that sort of convey particular aspects of a city?
I do. Although, in Sydney, it's... Well, I mean, the Lebanese thing, and there's obviously something to do with the pattern of immigration in Australia. But yeah, you've got to be careful. I mean, I was saying to a North American the other day that Sydney had a criminal reputation, and he just laughed, you know, because compared to some American cities, of course, that is a bit funny. But, I mean, the great crime story of Sydney is that corruption. For about 20 years, we had corruption here going from the lowest police officer right up to the Premier and the Police Commissioner, and that period is over now. I say it fortunately for the body politic, but unfortunately for me as a crime writer.
Yes.
But I'm strongly tempted to delve back into history, because that has actually shaped a lot of the city that I live in. So I think sometimes certain crimes can reflect a city, and I know what you're saying about Adelaide. I've read that book. It's very interesting.
Yes, indeed, yes. Well, I think Salman Rushdie actually called it Australia's Amityville, didn't he? Much to the horror of people in Adelaide, even though Adelaide's got no higher crime rate than any other city, but perhaps its share of more gruesome crime, certainly.
Melbourne, and I don't know if this is a Melbourne thing or just an accident, but that, you know, the crimes in the 1990s that went into that first underbelly, and you had these families up against each other, and you had even the women emerging as sort of celebrities. I thought, we've never had anything quite like that in Sydney, and that's something I'll always associate with Melbourne.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think probably there's crime in the particular cities in Australia and how they might differ in characteristics.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Michael, it's been terrific to talk to you again today, and I'm really pleased to hear that we're going to be reading more of your crime novels in the future that do look at lots of the current issues that we've sort of got in our society at the moment. So thank you very much for taking the time, and perhaps we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks,
okay.
Michael.
Bye.